Welcome, everyone, to these Goldster podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles to hear enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking about healthy living. Please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the next hour on this Goldster Inside Story, where we are going to discover why human beings are so different to animals. Crazy question. Let's think about it. Is it really? What is the background to our development that made us the predominant species? When, for example, did we learn to count? And what is the key thing that motivates us, given all the challenges around us, whether it's nuclear war or climate catastrophe? What of our future? Big questions for winter's Goldster conversation, and one in which my patient pull-out guest from the London School of Economics, no less, and author of the much-talked-about book, A Theory of Everyone, The New Science of Who We Are, How We Got There, and Where We're Going. Of which, before I let him speak a word, the Times columnist Matthew Saeed said this book will change your view of the world forever. Will it? Another big question from my end. Oh, yes, let's do some Goldster pushback on this one. He's an academic after all. When we're paying our mortgages, our student fees, reading about cancer rates, aging, Ukraine, Israel, Palestine, every day in the headlines, why should we care? Does it matter? Well, if I thought it didn't, our guest would not be with us today to convince, compel and enthrall us all on his theory of everyone. Welcome, Dr. Michael Muthukrishna, to Goldster Inside Story.
Thank you for having me, Humphrey. I'm so happy to be here.
It's very good. Very good to see you. And I'm glad you've got your book and cover and everything in the background there, because that is what we're going to discussing. So, we're not going to discuss everyone yet, but I do want to know, what exactly is a theory?
You know, I think this is probably, it's not a good idea to fail on your title, but this is probably my first mistake in the book with the opening title. The way that the word theory is used in the vernacular is a little bit like it's a guess, it's a hypothesis. You know, I have a theory about why my sister-in-law is doing this thing. But of course, scientists don't use that word in that way. So when we talk about a theory of evolution or we talk about a theory of gravity, what we're really talking about is a series of mathematical models, of computational models that are making specific testable predictions about the world. So when I talk about a theory of everyone, that's really what I'm referring to. It's not like a single hypothesis that can be summed up in a, you know, in a single line. It's a series of models that are making predictions about the world that I slowly unfold through the pages.
Okay, but these are predictions, of course, none of us can accurately predict the future, but you mentioned a theory of gravity. So is gravity a fact or a theory?
So a theory, you know, from a scientific perspective, anything can be overturned. But of course, the empirical fact of gravity is a fact, like we experience it every day. But explaining gravity, there are different theories to explain it. So you might have, you know, heard analogies like space-time and trampoline pads and so on, things like that.
I thought it was the magnetic pull of the Earth.
Well, we're not magnets, so that's a different force.
Oh, okay. So my attempted fact there is not working. Good. I'm glad. So we're getting to this fact and through thing. And you are an academic at the London School of Economics, from which your theories that you compiled. What do you do there?
So my official title is that I'm an economic psychologist, and I have affiliations in both data science and developmental economics. But my background is kind of unusual. So before I was at the LSE, I was at Harvard in human evolutionary biology. In grad school, I kind of cross-trained in economics, evolutionary biology, data science, and psychology. And in undergrad, I have a degree in engineering, where I started my career.
So this is why you have to find all these theories and bundle them all together, because that is so vast. But you said something there that caught my interest. You said economic psychology. I thought psychology was about the human mind, but it's actually not.
Yeah, it's about human behavior. And so I work on human behavior, particularly as it relates to economic decision making.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Our guest yesterday, by the way, was from Canada, and she was telling us how to manage our money. So we might mesh you two together. and continuing even further back on your background, you say something that I found very interesting and maybe motivated you to write a book like this. You said, in Sri Lanka, where I was born, I learned how two peoples who look so similar to outsiders, Tamils and Sinhalese, could come to hate each other. I learned how ordinary everyday existence can be even during a civil war. Unpick that a bit for us.
Yeah, you know, so when I, you know, so I was born in Sri Lanka. I left when I was about 2 years old, but we would, you know, we would visit regularly. And when you're a child, you just kind of accept the world as it is. You don't really think too much about it because you don't know what the world could be. And so you have military checkpoints, you have bombs going off from time to time, you hear about this war, and it just becomes normal, natural. People live their everyday lives, they drop their kids to school, they go to work, and so on. And as a child, I didn't really appreciate what was going on or what war meant. This was, of course, around the time of the Iraqi war, the first one in the early 90s as well. And so I thought, you know, there are these wars that happen in the world. So my family are kind of mixed ethnicities. So on my mother's side, they're Tamil. And on my father's side, they're actually Colombo Cheti, which is a completely separate ethnic group altogether. But my father was raised Sinhalese because his mother raised him, stepmother, had married a Sinhalese man.
In full flow, I know, is that the Tamils are Hindu and the Sinhalese are Buddhist. This is a sort of main...
That's right. And the Colombo Chetty's a Christian, hence my name, Michael, you know.
Right. Okay. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah. And so, you know, I knew that all of these religions and ethnicities existed, but to me, you know, I couldn't tell the difference between a Tamil person and a Sinhalese person as a child. I didn't even know that there were different kinds of Sri Lankan people. And of course, as both an insider and an outsider, to me, there were more similarities than differences. But that wasn't enough, of course. You know, those little differences, as we saw, you know, in somewhere like Ireland, are enough, right? Are you Protestant or are you Catholic? You know that old joke, don't you, Humphrey, about guy knocks on the door of the car. He says, you know, what are you, Catholic or Protestant? He says, I'm an atheist. He says, yes, but a Protestant or a Catholic atheist. You know? So, you know, these very minor divisions are enough to cause division. And these are the kinds of experiences that really got me thinking.
So this is it that experience, childhood experience of what you've just told us? Is that why you wanted to write a book called A Theory of Everyone?
I mean, it goes a little deeper, and our lives, you know, I think our lives make sense in hindsight. You know, we kind of tell ourselves these stories about how we got to where we're going. So I should add, you know, I grew up in Botswana at a time when, you know, Mandela was voted into power. So pre and post apartheid, that was very interesting. And I was in Papua New Guinea during a coup. I lived 500 yards from Parliament House. You know, I was actually in London in 2005. I was just visiting family when the London bombings happened. And if anything, actually, it was probably that moment, the London bombings, that really got me thinking about this, this issue of the role of culture in conflict. Because to me, you know, I was living in Australia at the time. It seems strange to me that you had second and third generation migrants, people who you spoke with a very clear Yorkshire accent. We're talking about us and them. And when they were referring to us and them, they weren't talking about their fellow countrymen. They were talking about us as a people who lived miles and miles away and them as their neighbors. And that was odd to me. It's like, you know, how did you end up with a society where people felt like outsiders when they didn't seem to be?
Okay, this is fascinating stuff. And you are, I think, as we were discussing before we came on air, you are a globalist, actually, because you seem to have grown up in every country in the world and all the rest of it. I want to nail down into the questions you ask in the book, which I found absolutely fascinating. And the first one, why are humans so different to other animals? And before you answer that, I want to say to our wonderful audience out there, if you've got any questions to ask Michael at all about anything, because that's the goals to rule, doesn't have to be about his book, put it in the chat and he'll answer if he can. He's an economic psychologist and a host of other multi-syllable words that I can't remember. Why are humans so different to other animals, Michael?
So why humans are so different to other animals. I'll give you the answer first and then how we got there. We rely, so every animal on Earth relies on two things to make its decisions. It relies on genetically hardwired instincts from genes that they get from their parents. And they rely on individual learning over their lifetime. So, you know, they might have instincts to eat certain foods and avoid others. And you might have instincts that, you might learn that the food is over here and the water is over there and the predators are there, so don't go there. We learn that over the lifetime. But humans are a new kind of animal because we have a third line of information, or what we call a second line of inheritance. And that is socially transmitted software, if you like, that we get from our societies. So not just genes from mom and dad and a lifetime of experience, but accumulated knowledge and technologies and wisdom and entire new ways of thinking that we are delivered through our society. So when a human child is born, it's a floppy, useless mess compared to a gazelle, which is ready to know what to eat and run around and do things. We're not like that. We have to learn everything. And the way that we have learned, the things that we have learned, are themselves evolving over time in the same way the genes are evolving. We call this cultural evolution. So the theory is called dual inheritance theory, and that is really what makes us different to other animals. And the signatures of that shift are everywhere in our physiology and in our society.
And just to sort of clarify one point, when you see a calf born, you mentioned a gazelle or a foal, they do get up and start running around immediately. We don't.
No, we don't.
It's not just because our limbs aren't strong enough. It's because our mind can't do it too.
That's right. Yeah. So what happened was that our brains tripled in size in the last few million years, which made it difficult for our mothers to birth us. So actually, you know, we talk about birth being a very natural process. For us, it's quite a dangerous process because of this massive encephalization. And so one of the solutions to that is to give birth a little early. So it's not that, you know, some babies are premature. All human babies are premature in that we're not quite ready for the world. We need a tremendous amount of care. And as a result of that, we need mom and ideally dad and family members to help look after us for quite some time as we catch up on the last several thousand years of human history.
So 9 months of gestation, that is premature because it should be longer so that we could get up and start crawling at least.
That's right.
You mentioned the social thing too. So a herd of cows or a wolf pack, that is a different instinct that they operate into us if we go to some sort of party or sort of rave party and start socializing there. That's different.
Yeah, it's different in that, you know, there's a lot of instinct going on in a wolf pack or a herd of cows, whereas we are an incredibly social animal. I think that's clear to everyone. But the way that we interact in groups is governed by that software. So, you know, we go beyond friends and family, right? So we don't just have like a wolf pack of just our immediate kin. We can cooperate in made up things like companies. We can cooperate in made up things like nation states. In rotary clubs, you know, we have different ways of socializing that are governed by a psychology that we call a norm psychology and an ethnic psychology or a group psychology. That's different.
So does that lead to, I'm sort of going back or maybe hopping to that original conversation we had when you said that everybody looks the same, but they're actually different.
Yeah.
Does that lead to this sort of tribalism in class structure or caste system or what? Is that a human thing or do wolves and cows have it too?
So groupishness, like an us versus them, is a very human thing. But what's interesting is that who is us and who is them and the size of that group varies over time and between societies. And in my field, we call this the puzzle of cooperation. So 12,000 years ago, Humphrey, yours and my ancestors were all hunter-gatherers. And we operated the scale of bands of related individuals, right? And then about, you know, 10,000 years ago is the rise of agriculture, 6,000 years ago, the rise of cities. And now we're in groups of somewhat related people who are interacting regularly. So the scale of our cooperation went up. But really, it was after the Industrial Revolution that we ended up in the kinds of societies that you and I take for granted in the West today, which is societies of anonymous strangers made up of people from all over the world living side by side together in commerce, in education, in the workplace, and so on. And that is incredibly unusual. It's incredibly unusual, not just historically, as I just mentioned, not just geographically, because some places that's not a safe thing to do, but even just like cross species, right? If you put a few strange chimps in a room together, you get a room full of dead and maimed chimps. We're not like that. We're socially tolerant.
They would kill each other.
They would. Yeah, they would attempt to fight with each other.
Would they kill each other as one group against the other, or would it be an individual?
Largely as one group against the other. So if you have a couple of related individuals, they won't kill each other. So you kind of get a beginning of groupishness there compared to another couple. So then you can almost have like a group level warfare. And chimps do go to war with other groups, by the way.
Okay, but you don't get that with, is less developed the right word, with dogs, cows, sheep. They're not groupish.
Well, they are groupish in that, you know, packs will go to war with other packs.
Okay.
But these packs are made up of related individuals. So across the animal kingdom, most cooperation that we see is among related kin. Humans can surpass that. That's what's interesting. And the big part of my book is in showing the latest science and how did we do that? How did we get to these large groups and what is threatening those groups? Why is it that some places are relatively peaceful and other places tend to fall apart? Like, what are those predictors of conflict?
Absolutely. That's because what you're actually saying is that the family in the animal kingdom is the group, like a mafia family fighting.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Organized crime,
yeah.
That's a group.
Yeah.
Whereas in the developed human society, you can go outside of the family and form group like NATO or the European Union or whatever it is.
Exactly, exactly.
So answer the question that you just asked yourself. How do we get there?
Yeah, so the first thing to note is that these different scales of cooperation undermine one another. And that is actually what we call corruption, which is, you know, a big part of my work is understanding corruption. So, you know, when a president gives a contract to his son, we say, well, that's nepotism. But it's actually the mechanism of what we call inclusive fitness or kin selection. In other words, family-level cooperation undermining institution-level cooperation. Or if a manager gives a job to a friend or a friend of a friend, we call that cronyism. But it's actually, you know, direct or indirect reciprocity. In other words, cooperation on the scale of people we know, our friends we know of, undermining our meritocracies, for example. So then you need a mechanism to say, well, what's driving this upward trend? Like, why is it that some places do cooperate at a higher scale? And the argument that I make is that it's really been energy capture that has been the major driver of large-scale cooperation over the course of human history. So the major event that took place in recent times was the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
So in this country here, on the back of cheap and available coal, what you might call stored sunlight. So, you know, you have peat and turned to black rock coal, and you have algae and zooplankton turned to oil and natural gas. These are compressed, dense sources of solar energy through photosynthesis, turned into chemical energy, and then compressed into something that you can burn. And energy is a great multiplier on your effort, right? Like, you can build a bookshelf with a manual screwdriver, but if you have a power screwdriver, it's a lot faster. Mm-hmm. You can cross the ocean, or you can drive, you can walk somewhere. But if you use the energy of a horse, you can get further, and you can get even further if you have a car or you have a ship or a plane. So energy is this great multiplier that allowed us to work together to where the benefit of working together outweighed the benefit of working in a smaller group. So if I want to exploit all of that coal, I need factories, which means I need workers, which means I need to educate them. Which means, you know, all of these things start to build out. And on the back of that, you build the largest empire the world has ever seen. And the reason that you and I are speaking in English today. And we see the same pattern, by the way, earlier than that. Sorry, go on.
I mean, this is, so energy, which we all know have been, you know, wars are caused because of oil and gas, which is the whole thing. The Ukraine thing is all about selling Russia gas and all the rest of it. Middle East is, you know, oil and that. This is the single motivator that both binds us and makes us enemies.
So, you know, theories are complicated, right? So there's the simple version of it. You know, if I were to say to you, gravity is like space-time, you know, it's bending and warping. But then if you get into the equations, it gets a little bit complicated. It interacts with other forces. It's the same here. So energy is the ultimate force across human history. But now there's the devils in the details. So just because you have energy doesn't mean you'll cooperate. And you can fight over other things because you're cooperating through energy, really, right?
Yeah.
So to say it another way, you know, our greatest achievements and our worst atrocities are group level behaviors. And in order to work together, I need to know that by working with you in a company, in a mafia, in a country, in an army or whatever, the benefit I'll get in that group is going to be higher than if I do it on my own, if I do it in a smaller group, or I join a bigger group. Okay. This dynamic, you know, I call this a law of cooperation. This dynamic ultimately is driven by energy, but what you can do with energy isn't just about your coal and natural gas and oil. It's also about the technologies with which you can do things with it, yes. Right?
So energy is a sort of practical, factual, I'm not sure if I can use that word in this conversation, factual thing that's there. And we might not realize it, but that is why we would join a group, or we would do.
Yeah.
Luke said Mark. So was it Groucho Marx said I wouldn't join any club that would have me.
Yeah.
But you say something in the book here, and I'll just pluck it out of whatever context. We can feel in our bones that something is wrong.
Yeah.
So you've taken us from that industrial revolution. You put energy up there as the sort of motivator, conscious or unconscious. And now we feel that something is wrong. What is that?
Yeah. So the analogy that I use in the book is you can think of our energy capture, and there's a specific metric called energy return on investment. So how much energy it takes to get some energy back, like how much energy do I have to invest in the coal mine? And then how much coal do I actually get back out of that? That's a kind of ceiling on everything that we can achieve. It's a ceiling. And the floor is based on our technologies and efficiencies. So, you know, if you have technologies that can take lighting, the first light bulbs, you know, Edison and Swan's light bulbs, very inefficient. Today, you know, if you've ever heard to save the environment, turn off the lights.
Yeah,
that's actually makes no sense anymore because our lighting is close to 100% efficient and it's not making a dent at all.
Okay.
Keep your lights on all day, every day, if they're LEDs, then okay. It doesn't matter. Honestly, doesn't matter. But so, you know, so we went from, you know, let's say, you know, 7% efficiency all the way to almost 100% efficiency. And that means you can do more. But there's a space that's created by this access and use of energy. There's a space. I call this the space of the possible. And all the cooperation and the evolutionary processes and our everyday lives of going to work and earning money and, you know, the goods that we can produce, the services that the amount of goods and services, the output of our economies is the size of this space. But because all of economics and, you know, all of psychology, certainly, but, you know, even a lot of evolutionary biology is after the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
We focused a lot on that efficiency floor. It didn't matter, this energy, because we had so much of it. You know, it was just pouring in. All that we had to do was do it more efficiently. So our economies were driven by advances in technology. You know, for anyone familiar with these kind of growth models, that A term, that technology term, is that's what was driving it, right? That and human capital, education, and so on. But something shifted.
Yes, what shifted? What is wrong?
Something shifted. So what happened was that now that ceiling, which we've ignored for so long, has started to kind of come down on us. So I'll give you a key metric. So in the early 20th century, one barrel of oil would get you another 1,000 barrels in terms of oil discovery. It was plentiful. It didn't matter, right? By 1950, one barrel of oil got you another 100 barrels, still a tremendous amount. But by 2010, one barrel of oil got you another 5. And energy is it's the great multiplier in human effort. So if you think about the economy as made up of goods and services, the amount of goods and services that we can produce is a function of our you know, our education, our intelligence, all of that stuff, and our technologies. But it doesn't matter how sophisticated your gadgets are if you can't run them. And so energy starts to matter a lot more.
So because I was mentioning, I mean, you've put it very clearly now of this one thing, which has been part of all our lives and our fuel bills. And
like the water that we swim in.
Electric cars, the water we swim in, this energy thing. But at the same time, your thing about something is wrong sounds a little bit bigger than that. And then you have another phrase in there. Out of context, I'm saying again, because I can't read you the whole book, the resulting anger and frustration can make our societies ungovernable, and we may lose faith in the fairness of our systems and in each other. That isn't just because our fuel bills are expensive. There's something else going on, isn't there?
That's right.
What is that?
So what's being triggered, now we're going to step back into psychology, right? So what's being triggered are zero-sum ideas. Zero sum means that your win is my loss and my win is your loss. And that is a completely different psychology to what we call positive sum or win-win situations where in a positive sum world, if you start a coffee shop and its business is booming, I might say, oh my God, the coffee business is booming, right? I should start a coffee shop too. And I'm going to make better coffee than Humphrey and I'm going to have a bigger business than him. And so you get this virtuous cycle where we're working to compete with one another and the consumer benefits with better coffee. That's the positive sum world. That's the world of plentiful energy, plentiful, you know, all of that stuff. We haven't yet hit the case. We're not yet in that scarcity world, but we're detecting that plentifulness is weakening. And so we're sensitive to this zero sumness. And it's triggering this idea that your group's win is my group's loss, or your win is my loss. The number of places in the good schools, the wait times at hospitals, how long you wait for the tube, all of that stuff is going up as our population grows, but our economy doesn't grow in part. So your size of the economy, your share of that size is growing down. And as a result of that, you're triggering the zero sum where you start a coffee shop, Humphrey starts a coffee shop, and I go, he's taken a piece of the coffee shop market. My high street can't have two coffee shops. So only thing I can do if I want to beat him in the coffee market is to burn his business down or somehow steal from him. And that's a very, very different psychology. And that's what's being triggered. So there's an analogy.
This is a trigger. And if anybody feels that they live in this zero-sum gain or win-lose-lose world, as it were, let us know your experience, whether it's a fuel bill or something like that. Just give us an idea. But you also talk about the fairness of systems. So mm-hmm. because, using your coffee shop analogy, that high street is perceived not to be able to have to, that's an unfair system. And then you think the whole of politics is rubbish and politicians are all liars and cheats. Is that how it goes?
Yeah. So we lose trust in our institutions. We lose trust in one another. We lose trust that those who are governing us are doing things in our interest and not their own. Because unless our futures are tied, unless our interests are tied, people's, you know, so if you benefit personally from creating a bigger economy where that benefits more people, then I can trust that, you know, you're going to do fine. I don't need to worry about the decisions you're making. I know that our incentives are tied together. But when that's no longer the case, now everybody, including our politicians, aren't necessarily acting on the benefit of all of us, right? That's been the case for a long time.
For a long time, 100 years, 50 years, 10 years?
Well, it happens during these boom moments, right? So when the Industrial Revolution happened, for example, the aristocracy was weakened, so the late 19th century, because it wasn't land and land ownership that was driving. There was these new industrialists. And so a lot of the aristocracy were marrying the industrialists, and that was what was happening. Yeah, and there was this moment. Before, if you think about something like education, which was the purview of the wealthy, it became given to the masses because their futures were in a sense tied to the industrialists who needed a working population who had more education than they currently had. So they needed to read and to write and to count and so on, right?
Well, actually, you've just given me a way back, and I want to go way back to millennium, actually, because our development and how we got here, I feel that we maybe skipped a bit. We're talking about the wolves and the cows and the premature birth. When did we as a human race start thinking, I guess, that the rule of law was predominant to our individual wishes, that sort of thing? When did, or the counting that you were meant, when did we actually learn to count, analyze, do all these equations and come up with theories? When did all that happen?
So, you know, I love your question because a lot of the things you're pointing to are parts of our software that are not human or instinctual. They came about at a certain point in history, right? So if you take something like counting, I'll start there and then I'll do the rule of law. So our ancestors and some societies today count like this. One, two, three, many. They don't have a full counting system. To do that, we had to use some kind of metaphor that we then mentally represented. So a lot of societies use body parts. We have 10, not because it's a special number, but because we have 10 fingers. Some societies use 12 because of the 12 phalanges, and other societies count on all kinds of body parts. We also use stones. So the word calculus, for example, comes from limestone, from stones. And then we would use these stones and press into clay to create notches. And so we had a symbolism. And that really emerges around the time of agriculture. So, you know, around 10,000 years ago, we see the beginnings of writing. We see the beginnings of counting in some societies. It's not necessarily the purview of everyone. Something like zero took a very long time to emerge. So even after we had a number system, the idea of zero is not well represented either on our body, like zero fingers, or in terms of stones, because zero stones is nothing, right? It's nothing. And so it took centuries before we got to zero. And then negative numbers, that was really the 17th or 18th century, because how do you represent negative numbers on your body or even with stones? It's very, very difficult.
So the 17th century, you couldn't have a minus bank balance.
So you had negative numbers, but they were very difficult to convey and difficult to understand. You know, there's this quote that I have in my book from a Canadian-British mathematician, Francis Mazarese, where he says, negative numbers darken the very fabric of reality. They're these horrible things. You know, everything would be fine without negative numbers. And then we had the number line. So the creation of the number line had a new metaphor for numbers, not objects, but movement and position. And it's still the metaphor we use to deliver that number system to children, right? And now zero is obvious, and so are negative numbers, and anyone can count, and you can count anything.
And alphabets?
So alphabets emerged, you know, with writing initially kind of.
So that was characters. After the numbers.
Well, that's a good question. It's around the same time. So it all emerges around.
There was a realization that in order to communicate, they needed to communicate numbers, trade, I presume, number.
That was the primary motivation. So you get the beginnings of writing where you have like, you know, so you might have like cows or something. You have a particular object. You press it five times to represent five lots of cows or something like that.
And this is why we're different to animals, because they never did that.
So you can represent these crazy things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then after that, my next question, I'm sure there were many other stages, was the rule of law, essentially, where a community presumably would have laws that superseded what the individual wanted.
Yeah, that's a big shift. And it's another one of those things, and it's not perfect, right? So the idea that we are ruled by laws and not lords, or, you know, by principles and not people, is different historians have made different claims about this. So one claim is that there's something very unique about Judeo-Christianity, in that it is a not capricious God doing, you know, all kinds of different things, but governed by some kind of rules. Like there are laws about the universe. And so you get a lot of very early Christian scholars and, you know, later Abrahamic religion scholars looking to understand those laws as a way to understand the creator. So some historians say, you know, that's the beginnings of the idea of rule of law. But even after that, right, it takes a long time. Like the king can do what they want.
Yes.
And it's really that imposition, you know, like, for example, the Church of England begins because that imposition is like, excuse me, you're telling me that as the king, I'm governed by some laws that are not just me and what I decide? That's crazy. So you always get a pushback.
So the concept of laws were that, you know, came in sometime, and then they have to come in. And is it the case?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to be very clear. There are rules, of course, in every society. They're informal, but there's a difference between kind of contextual rules and rules as kind of a objective, above everything, apply in all cases, and applied impartially. That's quite unusual.
So I'm jumping around now because this is so fascinating. So a flock of seagulls and a herd of cows would not have their own rules?
They have rules in the sense, like, they have genetic instincts. Yeah, exactly.
But they're not written down with the kids.
They can't be represented, you know? Yeah, people don't have, you know, if you're American or something, you know, seagulls don't go, well, what does the Constitution say? Let's argue about, you know, what a few guys in a room decided, you know, 250 years ago. like that, they would never do anything like that.
We're going to jump back to your high street now, because Iris Welford says, why did not the coffee shop owner and the guy losing out just lower his prices? Good question. I mean,
that is kind of what happens, but that's a different cycle to creating a better product. So you can still compete, right? But then the margins go down and down. And as a result of that, you're getting less and less. And so you, in that sense, you would prefer that that other coffee shop owner didn't exist. Yeah. Whereas if there's a booming market, like there's a large market, you don't have to do that. You can actually make better coffee and thereby make more money rather. Yeah. So here's another thing to say, another way to say it. In a business, it's always better to increase your revenue than cut your costs, right? In your family budget, it's better if you can increase your income than, you know, spend less money or find savings, if you can. So that's the difference between the positive sum and the zero sum world. It forces you to do different things.
Yeah. So jumping back again to the rule of law now, or where we've got to. So we've learned the count, we've done the alphabet, we're communicating.
There's more than that, Humphrey. There's much more than that. Even logic. So take this, right? So Alexander Luria, he's a Russian psychologist. Yeah. He goes out to Uzbekistan because there's an educational revolution happening where schools are being introduced to these rural communities. And he wants to know what they're doing to our psychology. And so he asks questions like this. Where it snows, the bears are white. It snows in Novaya Zemlya, what color are the bears? You immediately go, it's white. My six-year-old immediately goes, it's white. But what the Uzbeks who didn't have access to education would say, something like, I don't know, I've never been there. It's like, but listen to what I'm saying. Where it snows, the bears are white. What color are the bears in Novaya Zemlya? It snows. What color are the bears? It's, I don't know, maybe brown? I've seen a brown bear once. So, you know, even this tendency to reason in if P then Q logic with hypotheticals, it's not that humans are incapable of it. Obviously, we're not. We can. But that tendency is given to us by our education system. And we, you know, we replicate the same effects in Namibia and Angola, where I have a field site, among, again, populations who for education is just being introduced to them. Like we ask questions like, in this other place, boats are made of sand. I've got this boat from this other place. What's it made out of? They're like, I don't know, wood. I'm like, are you listening? Could it be made out of sand? And then they just laugh. They're like, what are you talking about? A boat made out of sand? So there's a grounded reality to the way that we ordinarily think that doesn't involve things like rule of law and, you know, these highfalutin kind of principles or, you know, hypotheticals that make no sense in the world.
And so, because I want to get on to the future in a moment, but the all these various sort of developments that we've had in our minds brings me up to two things, what you just said there. The firstly is that this thing of particularly the young and the social media that they have now.
Yeah.
That must be changing their psychology like to the Uzbeks. Just sum that up for us.
You got it. Exactly. So now if you take what I'm saying seriously, like you take the arguments in this book seriously, our software matters. And so we talk about generation gaps, right? And that is a gap in a shift in software. And for a lot of history, by the way, it wasn't a large gap, right? Like this is the moments, let's say, you know, the beginning from the 1970s onward, maybe around there. Maybe it happened in the Industrial Revolution at the very beginning, but certainly it's happened much more rapidly. For the first time, younger people, in many cases, are better equipped to deal with the world than older people. And I know we kind of take that for granted because we live in this world where technologies move so rapidly, but that is weird, right? For most of history, the elderly held a very highly respected place because the world didn't change all that much. And by virtue of living a long time, they had knowledge that was worth passing down. Now, elderly people always have knowledge worth passing down because that experience, some of that is timeless, right? It's just experience of being a human. But in terms of adaptation to the world, our software has shifted. So you're absolutely right. So what that means is that every generation, there's an opportunity and a danger and a whatever that the important things are not transmitted or that we hack our psychology or damage that software, give people poorly functioning software, if you like, software that's not ideal for them.
And are the social media silos that people talk about, are they a new thing or have there always been these sort of disruptions to the way people learn and communicate?
So the internet is brand new in a few different ways. I talk about this in the book, right? We had silos, but they tended to be geographic silos or class-based silos, right? Yeah. So you had a social group and you thought certain things in those groups and maybe you didn't have access to other people. The internet has done two things simultaneously. First, it's given everyone access to worlds they never had access to before, connecting us as never before. You know, people, I'm always blown away when I see American social movements spread into other places where they don't have as much relevance, like Black Lives Matter, right? That's a very specific problem about police violence in the American context. And we saw people, you know, protesting about this all around the world where actually the police aren't that bad. And there isn't it doesn't exist. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's because you have access to that.
Yeah.
You know, Hollywood but before
in London, it became a big political issue.
I know. Yes. I was like, what is happening right now?
Yeah,
exactly. And so you get connected and you have access, by the way, if you're directed about it, you can listen in on any conversation you want. You want to know what white supremacists think? You can go listen on that conversation. Yeah. You want to hear what Islamists or Jewish groups or men's rights activists or feminists or academics or anyone, any group you want, you have access to it through the internet.
And that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. But, what that is doing is creating new tribes.
Right.
So what it's doing for the first, so if you, are you a fan of Little Britain or have you watched it?
Yeah, that was about 20 years ago there, wasn't it?
Yeah, so you know Daffod, the character.
Yeah, I know
I'm the
mean.
Only gay in the village, right?
Yeah.
For a lot of history, he would have been the only gay, one of a handful of gay men in his village, right?
Yeah.
And even our dating pools, they were small. There's a, I forget his name now, there's a geneticist who pointed out the bicycle was a major boon for human genetics because it allowed you to date the neighboring village. You could meet halfway, you know? But the internet lets you find other people like yourself. So if you have any kind of, if you're a minority of any kind, and it could be a medical minority, right? You have a particular condition that it's not very common, so many doctors don't even know about. You can find other patients and you can swap knowledge in that way. Yeah. But it could also lead to QAnon. You know, it can lead
to the bad stuff
that goes, because our greatest achievements and our worst atrocities are group-based.
Yeah.
But the flip side is that if you allow the algorithms to passively feed you information, then depending on the algorithm, depending on the group, you can get siloed. So you can, you know, get siloed, but there's no answer to that question. It's an empirical question that depends on the algorithm. It depends on a bunch of things.
Is artificial intelligence that we keep hearing about, going through the same development process as our brains and minds went through? And will we get artificial intelligence tribes, societies, and wars?
So yes and no. So, I mean, I think there will be, if there's many different artificial intelligences, which there will be, then again, you get this groupishness, you know, my intelligence versus your intelligence, my group. Insofar as we're using the same artificial intelligence, we're all getting our news from BBC, Walter Cronkite, or whatever, then artificial intelligence has the potential to, once again, bring us back together with common norms, common ways of working. So if you and I are both, you know, we talk about the fact that it's like, I have a podcast that I'm going on tomorrow. And you say, I have a guest that's coming on tomorrow. What should I ask him? And I say, how should I answer the questions? Now, that artificial intelligence is coordinating us. So it can do that, right?
Yes.
But you asked me another question, which is, you know, is artificial intelligence the same way we are? Yes and no. So artificial deep neural networks were developed by Geoffrey Hinton, who was a psychologist, a neuroscientist. And what he thought is, let me recreate the brain in silica, in a computer. And he actually, he developed this stuff in the 80s. And then in the 90s, he kind of gave up. He was like, this isn't working. It's not a way forward. And other AI researchers like Marvin Minsky were like, why would smart people waste their time with a dumb idea like this? And it was the early 2000s that brain had enough data that it actually showed its effects. And that's what's led to ChatGPT and all of these large language models and so on. They're all based on this.
So
they're learning in a different way to us.
I want to move to the future now. Pauline Lacey has asked us a question that takes us there, I think. Are we then on the cusp of a new iteration of human cooperation? Is there a new iteration possible?
Yeah, so this is, you know, we will always have lower scales of cooperation potentially undermining. In the biological world, this is what disease is, right? So a cancer in your body is a few of your cells, like a tumor, going rogue and saying, I want to survive at the expense of the organism. And in society, when a group of people do that, politicians or business leaders, whatever, if they do that, it's a kind of cancer. It's a tumor in our society. That's always going to be there. And what the argument that I make is, what ultimately affects that, potentially at least, is whether we benefit by working together or we have a higher payoff by working in our smaller groups. So from my perspective, the next iteration of human cooperation is possible, but it's dependent on the next era of abundance. The kind of abundance that took place with the invention of fire, the kind of abundance that took place with the invention of agriculture, the kind of abundance that took place during the era of the Industrial Revolution, and we're living in the shadow of that. And we need that next era of abundance to get to the next level.
And this is back to your energy point again.
That's,
we need
back to my
sort
energy
out
point. Yeah.
This energy thing that we're
then going. The norms evolve over time, where groups that figure out ways of working in larger groups can take advantage of that to, in the case of the Industrial Revolution, colonize other groups. In the case of today, maybe build larger companies, work together in larger unions, solve problems that we face at a global scale.
Okay, so I'm now going to ask you a question that's come in from my guest, Michael Murthy-Krishna, there in his book, and he says, how can the answer to these questions be used to tackle some of the challenges we face as a species? Give us some answers, Michael.
Yeah, I'm optimistic because we have a lot of technologies. You know, we're investing again in nuclear, which, you know, we were very scared of in the 20th century, but it's come a long way in the same way that other technologies have. Nuclear fusion, there are some real possibilities. And if we crack that, we'd be the first generation of a galactic civilization. That would be a complete game changer. And, you know, in the meantime, we're getting better at solar for some places. That would be excellent. So I think...
Explain nuclear fusion.
Ah, so nuclear, we have, there's a big fusion reactor that we use a lot of. It's the sun. So nuclear fission is where you you break apart large atoms like uranium, plutonium. And when you break them apart, they release a lot of energy and you use that heat to turn a turbine and you generate electricity. Nuclear fusion is the energy of the sun, right? So you're fusing together hydrogen into helium and that produces a lot more energy. You know, we're talking like two orders of magnitude. And because hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, even, you know, and even tritium, we produce a particular isotope of hydrogen, we produce as a byproduct of some nuclear reactors. It means that it's like the sun. It's limitless. It's limitless.
So fusion is not, the nuclear power we've got at the moment is not nuclear fusion.
It's all fission. Yeah, it's fission based.
It's fission. So that's when you split the atom and...
That's where you split the atom. So the two bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
fission
bombs. Whereas now we have fusion bombs,
That's nuclear tribes cooperating, is it? As opposed to nuclear tribes
They're coming together. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, get technical, but yeah, like...
I don't want you to get you in trouble for simplifying things too much. But give us some... I mean, you say towards the end the people must do things, people must give us your argument there.
Yeah, so I mean, there are things I haven't even touched on. So, you know, the claim that I'm making is that we're at the scientific revolution in the human and social sciences in the way that we've discovered a periodic table. And we don't think the world is made up of fire, wind, water, and earth as the elements. We realize they're elements. You know, it's Darwinian evolution. It's this realization that the world is not just created, God says this, this, and this. It's evolving over time. And with that understanding, we can advocate for things that are better for us, that will lead us to a better place. So some of that is energy-based, but some of it is also around how we design our companies. So diversity, for example, it's fuel for innovation and creativity, and it's divisive. How do you overcome those divisions to take advantage of that diversity? That's one of the topics to deal with, right? And something we've used practically. Another example is what kind of a taxation system would be one that is optimally redistributive. It's rewarding people for innovation, but isn't harming, it's rewarding people, but it's also making sure that people have opportunities to use their talent. So there's a better match between opportunity and talent, which weakens over time if you're not careful.
So are we now talking about your theory for everyone?
I just want to be very clear. This is not my theory. If you had a guest on this show,
this is a theory.
If you had a guest on the show and said, I have a theory that explains it all, and you should be like, be a little skeptical.
So this is your...
I'm describing a lot of recent research in the human and evolutionary sciences that has bled over from all the way from biology through economics, psychology, behavioral science, political sciences. It's in all these fields. That periodic table that turns alchemy into chemistry.
Okay,
it's not my theory. I'm just a researcher in the field.
So your book is an encapsulation of these theories that impacts us.
A theoretical framework. Yeah,
I mean, I can understand and I can accept that we are still developing and that various things are going to develop our minds. And you have a bit in there saying that our IQ scores are rising.
So much we haven't touched.
And that the people were not as smart as, and we're smarter than that. When you come to changing the taxation system or the way we think about that, I can see these blocks in that it's so difficult to get anything like that across the line. We can't even reform our House of Lords here in Britain, which is the biggest unelected. In America, where everybody is sort of complaining or about the polarization and the election of a president that might not have the popular vote, they can't change that electoral college there that has been in place, as you said. So it's all very well coming up with your solutions, but how do you get them across the line?
Yeah. So let me say three things, right? The first thing is that the difference between a utopia or a better world the difference between like a utopia and an actually better world is the acceptance of those constraints. So in biology, when we talk about evolution, evolution cannot give you, if you say humans as a species require wings in order to become better, no chance, No chance at all. You can't evolve wings. It's too complex. But if you say humans need darker skin because, you know, they need protection from the sun and closer to the equator, that's possible. It's an adjacent possibility. So what the book is filled with are adjacent possibilities, small shifts that move us toward the right direction, like land value taxes, as an example. We can talk about that, but that's one example. The second thing to note is that when you realize that a lot of this is governed by software that is itself evolving, you realize that the world was built by people no smarter than you and I, and probably not as smart. And you believe that they are because you are only looking at the successes and ignoring all of the failures. And you're also forgetting that the people that rose to the top were rising to the top in a much smaller population where only a few had access to education. So the match between opportunity and talent was much weaker than it is today. And the third thing is, if you realize that a lot of the stuff is evolved, you're not trying to design better solutions. Sometimes it's obvious because you can see it somewhere else or it's a good match or whatever. What you're trying to do is create a system that can evolve better, can itself change faster. In the same way that the right to free speech allows ideas to flow, or in the same way that building a federal system or a company, like, so I use the example of Microsoft, which invested in OpenAI and has a resurgence, as being a shift that happened under its most recent CEO, Satya Nadella, when he said, this is a monolith. And what I need is a series of startups. I need a startup ecosystem where people are sharing ideas with one another and our futures abound. He didn't come up with the solutions. He created a system where the solutions would bubble to the top. Justice Brandeis referred to the United States as laboratories. Every state tries different things. And if it fails at a state or county level. And if it succeeds, it goes up to the federal level. If you centralize everything, you have a real problem with innovation, because whatever you do, you're scared of doing anything because it will reverberate around the country, first off. And the second is, it's very dangerous to do something in that way. So I propose things like startup cities or special economic zones as a way past that.
So
I'll leave it there. Yeah.
Given that we are talking here to a predominantly audience in Britain and we're both in Britain.
Where I live, yeah.
Without getting political on it, what would you suggest in your theory of everyone for Britain? You mentioned the states all yeah. trying with Microsoft.
You want me to go through this?
Go through it.
Britain needs more housing for one, and it needs better transport links. To do that, you're going to have to reform planning, and you probably want something like land value taxes that incentivize more efficient use of the land that you have available. You've got a problem with controlling borders in terms of immigration and in terms of a better match between skill and ability. That needs to be sorted out. Decentralization in Westminster is a bit of a blockade, and things like special economic zones might be a way past that. So Singapore, Hong Kong, they were engines of development for their regions in some sense, because you could try something at a local level. I could go on. there's all these kinds of principles that can work within the current system rather than say we need a revolution.
And have you seen anything with companies, the corporate world or the political world, that is heading in any of your directions?
Yeah. So, these things are, so I'm part of the Charter Cities Institute, for example, and there are countries like Zanzibar, and Tanzania that are building these startup cities, as I call them. You can call them what you want. This has been proposed in this country as well, but it's kind of, people don't understand what it is, I think, and they're a little bit afraid of that kind of change. There's also a lot of issues with trust. Companies are already embracing this. So, in the book, I talk about some work I did with Uber, where they use this approach to innovation to quite successfully deal with regulators here in this country. So I think there is movement in that sphere. And one of the bits of advice I got is, don't write a book because you feel like you ought to write a book. Write a book because it's bursting out of you. You can't not write the book. Mm-hmm. And so my real hope is that people read this, they reflect on it, see it in their own lives and say, I kind of have an idea what to do, or at least I know where to start that discussion.
Yeah. And that's the sort of final point I want to put to you, is that we've covered a range of things. But if you want us to take away one thing, one thought that we could transfer to somebody at a bus stop or having a cup of coffee or something that would compel them to be interested in our future, what would it be?
Let's do the Flynn effect. So we have gotten smarter generation by generation, and that has slowed down. education is a major means of delivering our software, which means that we are capable, our children are capable of far more than we think we are. And by investing in that next generation and giving them the tools they need to build a better world, they can, as every generation has.
So Suri says, and I'm not quite sure what this is, but I'm going to read it. Do you not think that mind is still a kluge? Do you understand that, Michael, a kluge?
You mean like a point that's like stuck or something?
I don't know. Tell us, Suri, what you mean by that. And does not all boil down to energy gain? I think this is what you're saying, isn't it? If we sort the energy.
Yes and no, I mean, ultimately we need to solve that. But what happens in that space is, you know, like you can get trapped in psychological traps. If you believe the world is zero sum, you can do things that lead it to become zero sum.
Yeah. But if we have this psychology that you mentioned in the book, that we think the system is not working for us, that is a bad psychology to have, isn't it? Because we
have to
work with this system, don't we?
Well, you know, there's both the reality and the psychological trap. So there could be a reality that people are. And then I think there are things that people should be angrier about, if I'm being honest.
give me one thing. What should we be angry about?
You know, I think, you know, all of the things that happened around, you know, let's say PPE corruption, you know, the farce that was the three prime ministers in 40 days or whatever it was, you know, there's those kinds of shambles. And
what should we feel good about?
At the same time, there are these major advances like in AI, in energy, in education. There are a lot of possibilities. It's a matter of whether we embrace them and use them to further concentrate power, or whether we use them to make the world better for more people.
That's it. Actually, Josie Morgan just mentions the Quakers had startups like Bourneville. They did. They had those cradle to grave, and Hershey, I think, in the States, the actual villages that did that.
Yeah.
Back where people could feel.
Yeah. No. There's lots
safe
of
in their lives, couldn't they? Yes.
Yeah,
and just wait there for a second. I have to tell our audience what is coming up next. That's Tuesday, January the 9th. We have Purpose, Passion, and Grit. Lucinda is with Poppy Lloyd, who is a veteran of working with street children in Africa. This has been investing in the next generation, and marketing director of First News, which is Britain's only newspaper for children. There we go. I didn't know that there was a newspaper.
Cool.
I used to read those comics when I was young, you know. Then January 11th, Lucinda is at a Riverstone live in-person and Zoom event with the wonderful novelist Amanda Craig and her new book, The Three Graces. January 12th, Rachel Trethewey returns to Goals to Insight Story with her new book, Mothers of the Mind. These are the mothers of Virginia Woolf, Agatha Christie, and Sylvia Plath. Yes, our mothers are a big influence on us. And January the 16th, Purpose, Passion, and Grit. I'm with Jeff Cox. His book is Somerset in the News, but we're going to be discussing communities. And after talking to Michael, we're going to talk about tribes and the future and trust and that sort of thing. What makes a community? And we want to know from you what makes your community. You have deliver this book. It has had some fantastic reviews. What is your next one, Michael?
I both loved it and hated writing the book. It was frustrating. I don't know. I mean, my focus areas right now in terms of research are on the intersection between AI, education, energy, and diversity. So thinking through like immigration policy, thinking through AI, thinking through all of these things. So the next book will probably bring some of those pieces together.
And are you going to have theory in the title, or you're going to have a different title?
I don't know. I think this title caused me lots of problems. I love the title. It's a play on a theory of everything, but
it's a great title because it's given us a wonderful conversation. Brilliant interview, says Marguerite Angelais. Thank you, Marguerite, for that. Kluge. Kluge is a haphazard evolution of the human mind. What was Sue's question there?
Not quite so haphazard. I think there are rules. There are rules by which humans work.
So we're not still in that haphazard state of mind. We're in full development there. A great interview, Chocolate. That's it. I think fascinating. Looking forward to reading your book, says Denise Spencer. I have to ask you what I call the goals to question, and you can do it for everyone, not just yourself. But when we feel that the system is failing, that the you know, everything's bad, that we can't get through the block. What tip do you give to us, everyone, for getting through that?
I mean, individually, we are a social species. Community, you know, your beliefs, using those as a rock upon which you build your life is a useful thing. But then also, as I said earlier, remember that a small group of dedicated individuals powered by a great idea with sufficient resources have always been what have changed our world. Anti-slavery, the suffragettes, like that's always the Quakers, you know, like that's always what's changed our world. And so change is possible. Don't give up.
Change is possible. And the community, which is wonderful. Yeah. The time's winged chariot approaches, if not for our goals to show, perhaps or perhaps not for the whole of the human race. Thank you all for being here. Until Tuesday with Lucinda and Poppy Lloyd. Stay warm. Keep thinking. Discuss a theory of everyone with family, friends, even enemies. Bring them into your tribe. Stay curious. Stay safe.
Especially enemies.
And stay girls. Thank you, Dr. Michael Mutti Krishna, for giving us such fun and a really thought-provoking show. It's great to see you, Michael. Many thanks.
Likewise, Humphrey. It's been a pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Bye. Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.